This week on COVID, Race, and Democracy, we will hear voices from the U.S. Capitol when pro-Trump protesters stormed the Capitol building on January 6th.
And start standing with Black Lives Matter against the repressive security services that the police comprise. That would be such a massive threat to the capitalist system.
We talked to investigative journalist Max Blumenthal, who was on the ground at the Capitol building.
We need the people to take to the streets because obviously the Democrats have lulled us into a false sense of security.
We'll also discuss what working people can do about the danger of violent racism amidst the worst pandemic in over 100 years.
They have done well by enlisting non-elite Euro-Americans to vote for the GOP, but now the non-elite Euro-American base feel that they have not profited sufficiently and therefore are storming the Capitol.
And author and historian Gerald Horn weighs in. This is COVID, Race, and Democracy. I'm your host, Ann Garrison.
People are the ones who are going to have to fight. We used to say, which side are you on? Which side are you on? The truth is, we're in so much debt that the only way out is revolution or war. So now the question is, which side are you on? On.
Which side are you on, boy? Which side are you on?
First, voices of those who protested and stormed the Capitol building on January 6th.
This is Thomas O'Rourke. We're on the ground here on the east side of the Capitol building.
The one percenters want to take control of the globe, and America is the last, the golden arc, if you will. Am I right in saying that?
Yeah, the economic format. They hate Trump. They hate him because he said America first, right? And when he said that, that was it. They couldn't deal with him no more, right?
This 2016 is when he f***ed your plan off because Clinton's, Obama's, Biden were all into it.
And the Republicans were no better back then. If you remember watching the primary, they were scumbags back then, right?
It's all part of it.
It's both sides. And both sides.
He's an outsider.
Do you know the history of Biden?
I do. War on drugs.
Everything.
How about the war in Iraq?
We view Trump as our last hope. Without him, right? Then we feel.
Well, I want to know why.
Last hope for what?
Because he's an independent, bro.
Right.
So let's get his story.
Last hope. No, I'm a citizen journalist. It's a radio station.
Okay,
some audio footage. That's all.
Sure.
You know, because
it's
happening.
Right.
And my God, this is as dramatic as it gets.
You know, we're not burning anything down. And there's a difference between us and them, right? And we're showing them today, right, that we have power, right? We, the people,
but
still have power.
When you say them, you have to really be specific. Because what them is now, is a global coalition.
It's a
coalition to be global dominant now. They have so many ties. You got Soros in there, you got the media, you have the tech industries, you have it's Facebook.
Well, there's Rothschild.
It all funnels down to this like chokehold on America.
Listen, they want to kill the middle class. They're going to kill the middle class.
Hasn't the middle class been attacked through the destruction of unions for the last 40 years?
Absolutely.
Hasn't the average wage been declining for American households since the early 70s?
The political bull goes down with the unions in our government. Let me ask you a question, man. We're supposed to get, what, $900 billion in stimulus? Our country, for the stimulus bill, $900 billion.
Yeah.
It broke down to like $12,800, something like that, per citizen. America, right?
Mm-hmm.
We got less than 10% of that. We got 5%. $600.
I didn't get a dime.
But let me ask you a question.
Yeah.
Why are we getting 5% of the big picture?
What was the point of Russiagate all this time?
Russiagate?
Yeah.
to just discredit Trump.
Yeah.
Because if you look at, dude, the whole time, 4 years Trump was in office, it was Russia, 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 collusion, collusion, collusion. Yeah. Now that they're, now that it's over and that it's the tide turned, it was the most pristine election ever.
That's,
I mean, are you fucking kidding me?
That's
actually fake stuff that got passed through. This FBI, CIA, judges are stamped out. Oh yeah, this is real. Here you go.
Fight for Trump! Fight for Trump! Fight for Trump! USA! USA! USA!
The segment you just heard aired originally on WPFW's On the Ground with Esther Iverum. We thank Thomas O'Rourke for the recording.
See, before I draw the line, let me welcome you close to all the folks who knew Obama sold the people a hoax. Gave the money to suckers while our community's still poor. Withdrew the troops but started another war. Colonizing, terrorizing, creating the oil crisis so they can make a killer, no food and gas prices. Prisons is filling, they trying to lock up the future. Militarized borders and control of computers. Want a stupid bumping music that ain't healthy for the shortest. Privatizing schools and policemen in the hallways. Can't be dormant, I've awoken. Rise up, be ready, brought the family with us, and we hold the machetes,
riding the fence.
WPFW's Esther Iverum also spoke to Dr. Gerald Horn about the protests at the Capitol. Here's part of their conversation.
Questions remain about the lax security and policing at the U.S. Capitol on January 6th, and even about what appears to be definite collusion between police and law enforcement in allowing the storming and vandalism of the U.S. Capitol, which resulted in 4 deaths, dozens of injuries, and scores of arrests. As the mob rioted after incitement by President Trump, there is mounting tension about what more Trump may incite with only 12 days to go before the inauguration of President-elect Joe Biden. Well, joining me to discuss this is On the Ground's geopolitical analyst, Professor Gerald Horn, the Morris Professor of History and African-American Studies at the University of Houston. The most recent of his 36 books is The Dawning of the Apocalypse, The Roots of Slavery, White Supremacy, Settler Colonialism, and Capitalism in the Long 16th Century. He just gave me your first thoughts on what for D.C. was a harrowing day.
Well, it was an attempted counter-revolutionary, fascist-minded coup. It reminded me of how European settlers in North America some centuries ago sacked Native American villages and seized their land, or how enslavers plundered African villages, particularly in West Africa. The rioters, the insurrectionists, as they're now being called, were not coincidentally defined as, quote, white, unquote. That is to say, in this settler colonial nation, which was based upon class collaboration between poor and richer Europeans in order to pillage Native Americans and Africans for their mutual advantage, it seems that those in the vanguard of this riot were dissatisfied with how the nation is going, because in 2021, that 16th and 17th century model of development is not easy to accomplish. That is to say, plundering and pillaging Native Americans or Africans or Iraqis or Afghans, for that matter. So they attacked the political leadership of the United States in order to effectuate a coup and a regime change so that they could reinstate the preferred model of development. Now, unfortunately, many of our radical friends and progressive friends, they tend to see the Trump base as yearning for a Green New Deal and Medicare for all. But fascist-minded forces, the Proud Boys, the Boogaloo Boys, QAnon, the Three Percenters, they are not progressives in disguise. They want remedies only for those defined as, quote, white, unquote. And more than this, the left that prattles on about the progressivism allegedly of 1776, these fascist-minded forces recognize that 1776 created an apartheid society. So they are more true, in a sense, to the founding of this country when they want to turn the clock back, as opposed to many of our liberal and radical friends who have this mythology about the alleged progressivism of 1776. Now, some on the left, I'm afraid to say, also see this discussion of fascism as a distraction from discussing another relevant point, which is the neoliberalism of the Democratic Party, but they are seemingly unaware that it's possible to fight both. The U.S. ruling class also has a dilemma. They have done well by enlisting non-elite Euro-Americans to vote for the GOP and deliver tax cuts and other giveaways to the 1%. But now the non-elite Euro-American base feel that they have not profited sufficiently and therefore are storming the Capitol. Not only that, but the currency of whiteness and privilege does not mean as much today as it did, say, in 1960. And so therefore, you have this January 6th insurrection. The U.S. ruling class is trapped. They need a new base, since the current base is sought to overthrow the Congress that has delivered so well for them. But no new base is in sight. As for the non-elite Euro-Americans who stormed the Capitol, it will be difficult to assuage them with higher minimum wage or better health care, since that will be a class-based remedy, and they want a race-based remedy for whites and whites alone. So Trump and his ultra-right mass base are wearing many of the hawks. I was astonished by the letter that appeared in the Washington Post earlier this week, initiated by Uber hawk Dick Cheney and other former Pentagon chiefs, including Donald Rumsfeld,
right, which
warned the U.S. military not to get involved in domestic U.S. politics. And as the Financial Times of London said in an editorial, what do they know that we don't know? Why are they warning the military not to get involved? But of course, a few days later, you had the attempted coup of January 6, 2021. It's well known that the ultra-right has infiltrated not only police departments, but the U.S. military at the highest levels. And I have to say that one of all the astonishing pictures emerging from January 6, one of the most astonishing was the sight of the black police officer being chased by the ultra-rightists, as opposed to him bringing the ultra-rightists to heel.
This has gone one coup too far.
He's jeopardizing a $20 trillion enterprise known as the United States of America. And somebody had to pull his coat. So now he says, well, I'm going to be involved in the orderly transition towards Biden. People should be prosecuted. But in the meantime, Betsy DeVos has just resigned.
We thank WPFW's On the Ground with Esther Iverum for sharing this audio. Listening to Pacifica Radio's COVID Race and Democracy. I'm Ann Garrison. I spoke to investigative journalist Max Blumenthal, founding editor of the website The Gray Zone, Investigative Journalism on Empire, about the January 6th Capitol riot. Max Blumenthal, thanks for going down to the Capitol to actually watch, photograph, and stream what you saw, and then talking about it on your Gray Zone webcast.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay.
Joe Loria, the editor of Consortium News, wrote a piece I liked called Capitol Incident Address Rehearsal. I recommend that. But he also said that there were so many video cameras, cell phones, that we could all understand what happened. But I didn't feel like that was true at all. We saw various camera angles and focuses and so forth. Can you tell us about what was going on in front of the Capitol building, where you said on your webcast that there were 15,000 protesters?
Well, this was a Stop the Steal rally that Donald Trump and the sort of grassroots pro-Trump movement had organized. And they marched from the White House to the front of the Capitol, and rafters were set up. And basically, they just took over the front lawn of the Capitol and charged in immediately through police barricades. And thousands of people stayed on the lawn, and several hundred burst inside the Capitol. And this was part of a plan that had been hatched at least several days before. I've confirmed that with some sources who were inside. And so the plan was always to break into the Capitol. For whatever reason, I mean, this is pretty interesting, or you could say disturbing. The various law enforcement agencies, I think there are 33 agencies in DC with the power to arrest, had no intelligence on this, or they chose to ignore these obvious plans to break into the Capitol because Capitol Police were completely overwhelmed. There were very few of them surrounding the Capitol. There were very few of them inside. And once inside, the invading mob was easily able to just push the police aside. In many cases, the police just kept falling back and didn't even... They tried to coax the crowd into leaving, and then when they said, "We're not leaving, this is our house," they were just kind of pushed aside, or the cops would stand aside. Down to the last moment, when a woman named Ashley Babbitt was shot trying to break through some windows leading to congressional offices. And I suppose the Capitol Police had made a decision to use lethal force to prevent the mob from getting into this area where Hill staff and possibly members of Congress were barricaded in their offices.
Do you have a guess about how much of the crowd that gathered at the Ellipse were there to storm the Capitol building?
Well, 100% of them were, but not all were participants, but this was openly celebrated. I mean, just being among the crowd. I got there right after they were pushed out after the shooting of Ashley Babbitt, which kind of stopped them dead in their tracks. And I tried to get inside, but as I tried to go in, there were guys coming out with blood on their hands because they had touched her body or attempted to revive her. And then the police were pepper spraying everyone. And they had actually finally mobilized some kind of riot police. But the whole crowd was supportive of what took place. So it wasn't as if there was some kind of special advance force or like shock troops that had planned without anyone else knowing to break into the Capitol. But such a disproportionate percentage of this group was ex-military, former law enforcement, or current law enforcement, that they began rappelling up the sides of the Capitol with ropes, and they made it up the side of the Capitol in seconds. It was like a military-style operation. And Ashley Babbitt herself was in the Air Force, had military experience, and seemed like it was just another mission.
Yeah, you say you ready for war, but are you convinced? I'm not convinced. If you're a rider, freedom fighter, crowd excited, then let's do this. We can make one big united middle finger to the U.S. Give me the bravest and the truest, the hippest and the coolest. We gon' spark this revolution and cross this off our to-do list. Put your foot down if you look down on this criminal system. Put your book down and get shook down like my niggas in prison. Don't be condemning and condoning their actions in one sentence. Make up your mind, choose your side. Is you a patriot or a menace to society? So riot or sit by quietly. But don't pull out your flag and try to say you gon' ride with me. You flip-flopping like hip-hop. I don't get locked in that trick box. Get got like Big and Pop. It's got to stop. I am the people, not the big. I repeat after Fred. So please.
I think there are contexts where people who are attracted to the more extreme currents of U.S. politics, who are interested in basically burning it all down as a way of playing out their own personal psychodrama, can get mental health support. If we actually had a medical system in this country that was public and supported people. But we don't. I think mental health is a huge issue here. I'm actually working on a piece about it, about someone who participated in a very central way in the riot in the Capitol, who I interviewed, whose family I interviewed, who's clearly suffering from psychological trauma and mental health issues and playing it out through extreme politics. And there were a number of people I met there who just had apparent mental health issues just in speaking to them. But most of the people there that I met had a fairly coherent worldview that made it absolutely impossible for them to shift, and which helped them, I think, maybe resolve some of their own issues living in a decaying capitalist society, but which prevented them from having a critique of the sources of their problems. I mean, a classic example would be Ashley Babbitt or any of the veterans there who feel listless in their suburban, exurban, or rural lives and are looking for action, looking for operations. They've been trained and programmed in a way that makes them insensitive to violence and often insensitive to human life. And they just need to get amped up. So this is what this provided them. But I think the worst barrier, the most extreme barrier to actually talking to these people, and I tried. I mean, after Ashley Babbitt was shot and the word was getting around, I would engage larger, not large groups, but groups of like 5 to 10, mostly men, all different ages. And I would say, can you understand why people in my city would protest police brutality? Because These are people who declare Antifa and Black Lives Matter to be their ultimate enemy. And obviously, if they would drop that barrier and start standing with Black Lives Matter against the repressive security services that the police comprise, that would be such a massive threat to the capitalist system. And they won't do it because of the way they're programmed by the online media that they consume, by the QAnon conspiracy theory, this anti-establishment narrative that leads generally white people with lower education levels into a kind of political cul-de-sac where they're actually advancing the really cynical designs of one wing of the establishment, the Trumpist wing. I'm down with the movers and the shakers and the ex-henny drinkers, the non-smokers, the health advocates, the non-voters, the young bloods in the hood training like soldiers. I'm on the side of the tracks with the hood gardens, the little child that don't color inside the margins. I don't ride the fence, I cultivate my strength, cause if it ain't about power, it don't make sense. I've been down with Boogie Down since BDP, some brown pride and black power make RBG. A OG told me choose battles wisely. In the struggle, don't forget your children and your wife. If you don't see me on the podium preaching it, every day I hope my every action is teaching it. Cause revolution is a process, it's not a speech or a panel. Don't bite off more than you can handle. I was very supportive of the force the vote tactic that was being deployed in the week before this catastrophe at the U.S. Capitol. The grassroots left was gathering a lot of momentum and applying pressure on the so-called squad, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Ilhan Omar, Ayanna Pressley, all these characters who are portraying themselves as the true progressive wing of the Democratic Party, to withhold their votes for Nancy Pelosi as House Speaker until she agreed to bring Medicare for All to a floor vote. And this would have been fantastically educational and instructive for everyone to see who supports healthcare during a pandemic and who doesn't. And it would have, I think, brought to the surface the real crisis in the Democratic Party, which is that it is undemocratic. It doesn't support the will of its own constituents, who at rates of over 80% support Medicare for All. So even though they failed to gain consent from the squad rejected them. AOC forcefully condemned Jimmy Dore, this comedian and pundit who was leading the charge. She accused him of violence for basically rhetoric that he was using that was not in any way violent or threatening. And they were exposed in a big way. And then they all cast their votes for Nancy Pelosi. I mean, you had Rashida Tlaib, one of the first Palestinians to serve in Congress, someone who is very vocal about their Palestinian identity and support for Palestinian sovereignty. And she cast her vote for Pelosi, who is one of the most Zionist pro-Israel House speakers in recent memory, someone who just supports every Israeli action. So the hypocrisy was on bold display. And I think what this did was give the left a lot more momentum to say that the Democratic Party is not our vehicle and we need to put pressure on them. Jimmy Dore was saying they need to be afraid of us, the people, and start listening to us. And I think he was channeling a lot of the rage that exists in the authentic left grassroots and bringing people in who maybe even didn't identify as left before into a more socialist mindset. And then I would say 2 days before the Capitol was stormed, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez issued a very telling statement that foreshadowed what was to come and suggested some kind of knowledge or understanding of the looming right-wing menace and a desire to exploit it to guard her left flank. She said that we need to unite and unite against right-wing violence and extremism, and that's why I cast my vote for Pelosi. So 2 days later, the Capitol is basically invaded, at least. Members of Congress had to barricade in their offices. I'm not sure to what extent they were threatened, but I wouldn't doubt that they were. There was an evacuation. I witnessed part of it. Buses were brought up to evacuate members after they were basically taken to the basement. And AOC tweets that she was threatened and barricaded in her office and so on. And now the squad is talking, they're focused on forcing the resignation of Senator Ted Cruz, one of the Republicans who supported the kind of Trump Stop the Steal demonstration and the general narrative that the election had been stolen. But they're not talking about healthcare. This is the perfect deflection for them, just to focus on the right wing, invoking the 25th Amendment against Trump. And the whole discussion about forcing a Medicare vote has been taken off the table.
You are listening to COVID, Race, and Democracy, a show produced by Pacifica Radio and its affiliates around the country. Find out more about our work at our website, covidtaskforce.pacifica.org.
Only days before January 6th, Pacifica's Steve Seltzer interviewed Vermont AFL-CIO President Dave Van Dusen. The State Federation had called for a general strike if Trump tried to overturn the election and warned about not preparing for the future. Here's that conversation.
Well, look, apologists or wishful thinkers from the beginning keep saying, oh, after the next crazy thing, Trump will walk away, right? And each step of the way, Trump and his people have said, no, we're going to fight this. We don't give a damn, essentially, about democracy. We're going to do everything we can to retain power. So it's time for the left, the broad left, to wake up and see the danger that is before us. The fact that former high-ranking military officials felt the need to come out the other day to say there's no place for the military in reversing the election results shows what kind of danger we are in right now. The fact that the president of the United States, Donald Trump, is planning to meet with and encouraging fascists to march through DC demanding he retain power, and that the legitimate election results where Joe Biden won not be recognized, is a sign of the absolute crisis that is emerging within our democracy. We cannot rest on our laurels. We cannot hope that he walks away. We cannot hope that there isn't going to be more militant coup attempts between now and January 20th. We need to be ready. We need to be steadfast. And we need to be prepared to do whatever it takes to defend democracy against fascism. And that's what this is. This is fascism. And this is a coup attempt to overturn our tradition of representational democracy in the United States. Priority number one needs to be to defend the election results and to get Trump and his neo-fascists out of office, out of Washington, D.C. That needs to be the first priority. But let's not kid ourselves. This was not the start and end of a crisis of democracy. It is the beginning of a crisis of democracy. We need to be prepared that in future elections, this is going to be the playbook that the far right uses to say, hey, you know what? Our years of voter suppression, maybe that doesn't always work. Our attempts to keep low income and people, minority folks from voting, that hasn't worked. So now when they see they can't win fair and free elections, more and more, they're gonna open the door to extra legal means to retain power. We see this happening right before our eyes. This is no longer a speculation. This is what's gonna happen. A huge amount of far-right Republicans are gonna vote against certifying the Democratic results of the election. So that shows you this is well within the mainstream. This is the new fear and the new danger and the new reality we have to deal with. So even if we get through this and Biden is sworn in on January 20th, labor now more than ever has to prepare to go above and beyond and develop new avenues of power in order to resist attacks on democracy. And in fact, not just to resist the attacks, but to grow strong enough where we could go on the offensive and build more democracy in our society, both in the workplace, both through the political system, and on every level of society. So this is what we need to do. And the old ways of doing things with cozying up with some key Democratic figures in Washington, D.C., that has failed us on multiple fronts. And that will not protect us when faced with the dangers of the rise of fascism in the United States. In the short term, our priority needs to be the removal of Trump from power and the defense of the democracy we have. And at this particular specific juncture in history, we need to have a broad united front against those forces that are now overtly opposed to any democratic process in this country. And of course, that means working with the Democratic Party. And it also means working with pro-democracy elements within a more traditional Republican Party. That is the broad coalition that we need at this moment. But let's not make any mistake. The Democrats gave us NAFTA, which killed hundreds of thousands, millions of American good-paying union jobs. It gave us decades of imperialism and foreign intervention into the developing world. And it gave us lower standards of living for our workers and a degradation of union rights throughout this country. So in the long term, no, we cannot rely on the Democratic Party as true allies in the project that's before us. And we need to be going beyond that. We need to be looking at alternatives. We need to develop our power in the shops. We need to develop our power in the streets, which means building alliances with social justice organizations and movements throughout the United States outside of our traditional labor allies. And it means looking at third parties, leftist parties, which we can build to be a competitor with the two primary, essentially more conservative capitalist parties in this country, the Democrats and Republicans. I see this as the beginning of massive organizing across the United States. Let's not forget that during the 1930s, while some economists would argue that downward negative economy suppresses organizing efforts, but that was not the case under the Great Depression. There was massive organizing going on during the Depression when people realized it really truly is, as you said, a matter of life and death, a matter of being able to support your family or not, as to whether or not you have an organization that could fight for you, that you could be part of, that you could advance your class interests through. So I do see this as a start of something. And we need to do everything in our power to not put our resources into the very limited game of winning this election or that, but we as labor need to put our resources into backing these new organizing drives, to supporting the class demands of working people across this country, and to build those grassroots necessary from which something else can grow. So we have a huge task in front of us. But again, let's not forget that the task over the next few weeks is to defend democracy and make sure Trump does not succeed in his efforts to pull off an anti-democratic coup in this country.
Feel the beat.
You're listening to Pacifica Radio's COVID, Race, and Democracy. I'm Ann Garrison. Professor Francis Boyle teaches law at the University of Illinois in Urbana-Champaign. He has focused on international law and civil rights around the world, as well as rules to protect us from biological weapons. He talked with Pacifica about what he claims are actual crimes committed by Trump and his collaborators.
Let's just start with the two federal statutes directly on point so that people can understand how serious this is. The first one is seditious conspiracy. And that is clearly what I think we have seen. And it has not been dissolved. I think the seditious conspirators are still there. They're still in power. I think the situation is extremely dangerous. We can discuss that in a bit if you want. And then second, the second federal statute you can Google is insurrection or rebellion. And clearly the speech that Trump gave on Wednesday was an incitement to an insurrection that fits directly within that statute as well. His son, Don Jr., did, Giuliani did, and this Professor Eastman, also from this right-wing reactionary law school out there, Chapman in Orange County, clearly they incited an insurrection. So this is very serious business here, and if you add it all up, yes, I believe what we saw is a coup d'etat. The news media, the mainstream news media is not facing up to this, if you've been following it as I have assiduously. But I'm afraid that's what we saw. And since we have a seditious conspiracy here as defined by federal criminal law, it has not been dissolved. The conspirators are still out there, Trump Jr., Giuliani. It is also clear, as you were saying to me, that an order was given to stand down and not protect elected representatives there in both the House and the Senate. They were sitting ducks. And so, again, it's extremely dangerous. The Democrats have been completely feckless in dealing with this situation. After they did return and they certified Biden, his election, so fine, but then they adjourned. Are you serious? They should have been in session all day Thursday and have Trump impeached by the end of the day and the article of impeachment delivered to the Senate for a trial opening today. Whether or not this would succeed is not the issue. It would have identified the problem immediately. It would have neutralized and immobilized Trump. He's still in power. He's still dangerous. He's still commander-in-chief of U.S. Armed Forces. Right now, we have 6,000 members of the National Guard right there in the Capitol in Washington, D.C. Trump is their commander-in-chief. Basically, Washington, D.C. is under a situation now of de facto martial law. So it's a highly volatile and dangerous situation, and I think we have to understand that. This coup d'etat was long planned. All you had to do was watch Hannity and Laura Ingraham on Fox News, which I do, and it was clear this was coming. Everyone knew it was coming. It was a coup d'etat in plain sight, and nothing was done to stop it. And the conspirators, in my opinion, are still at large, and we don't know what's going to happen now. So it's a very volatile, dangerous situation, certainly between now and January 20th. And in my opinion, the Democrats should have been dealing with it first thing Thursday. We should be having an impeachment trial today. And that has not been done. We need the people to take to the streets, because obviously the Democrats have lulled us into a false sense of security. And here I speak as a former official of our labor, of our union here on campus. I was greatly honored that the my brothers and sisters in chapter here, AFL-CIO, American Federation of Teachers, elected me to serve three terms on our professors union, as well as our delegate to the AFL-CIO County Board. So, right, I'm labor myself. We need people taking to the streets now and opposing what is still, I think, an ongoing coup d'etat. We haven't seen the end of this at this point in time. And again, it is a seditious conspiracy defined by federal criminal law. Nothing's been done to stop the conspirators, to dissolve this conspiracy. They're going after all the small fry here, not the ringleaders, Trump, Giuliani, Trump Jr., and Trump's enablers and facilitators here. We have Senator Cruz there, Senator Hawley. We have, you know, 139 members of the United States Congress. What's going on here? That's the question I have to ask. I don't think that we, the American people, let alone members of labor, we need to stand up here and take to the streets peaceful, nonviolent protests and demand to save our republic. Right. We have no idea what's going to happen between now and January 20th, except Trump is still in power. He's still commander-in-chief of U.S. Armed Forces. He now controls the 6,000 members of the National Guard that are in control of Washington, D.C. under de facto martial law. So I think this is really a crisis for our republic. And, yeah, the union should be out there and mobilizing their people right now as we speak to take to the streets, right?
You're listening to Pacifica Radio's COVID, Race, and Democracy. I'm Ann Garrison. Imam Jamil Al-Amin, formerly H.Rap Brown, is in a struggle against a political frame-up by forces that want to keep him in prison for life. In the midst of the COVID pandemic, his life is under threat, as are the lives of millions of other prisoners. Heather Gray, with Pacifica affiliate WRFG Radio Free Georgia in Atlanta, reports on the case.
See, it's no in-between. You're either free or you're a slave. There's no such thing as second-class citizenship.
This is Heather Gray from the Pacifica affiliate station WRFG in Atlanta, Georgia. Today, I'm going to be talking a bit about the case of Jamil Al-Amin, formerly known as H.Rap Brown. H.Rap Brown ultimately took the name of Jamil Al-Amin and, as a Muslim leader, was the influential imam in Atlanta's West End, where he consistently attempted, among other missions, to end the drug invasion in the West End community in Atlanta. Then in 2000, an Atlanta policeman was killed, and Al-Amin was accused of this crime. Yet all the indications are that he was not the killer. In fact, evidence that an individual named Otis Jackson confessed to be the shooter on the evening of March the 16th, 2000. This was never introduced at trial by the prosecution or the defense. Otis Jackson continues to maintain that he was the assailant.
That you had committed a murder and were involved in the shooting of a cop in March of 2000 in Atlanta, Georgia.
Yes.
You did?
Yes.
All right, you weren't arrested for it, were you?
No, sir, I was not.
In fact, another person was tried and convicted.
Jamil Alameen, yes, sir.
Yes, sir.
Alameen is now in the United States prison in Tucson, Arizona, where he is housed in the general population. He continues to declare his innocence, and supporters are advocating for his return to a Georgia facility where he will be able to assist his legal team in appealing his conviction. The following is an interview with Bilal Suni Ali, who is a close friend of Jamil Alameen.
We need to pump it up, pump it into people's minds, actually what happened, the things that happened, because there's so many people that just say, oh, that's a guy affiliated with the Black Panthers, and he shot somebody, so he must have did it. They say he shot him because they say he was affiliated with the Black Panthers. But they don't tell you what work was he affiliated with the Black Panthers. He was part of the organization that the Black Panthers got their name from. He wasn't ever a member, except an honorary member of the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense. But he was part of an organizing effort in the Deep South of registering people to vote. People were being killed for registering to vote. And people were being killed for escorting.
And he was supporting folks who were voting in Alabama and registering and so forth.
Exactly.
And going to the polls.
And they had...
He was helping them.
And they were with shotguns.
Yeah, I know.
So he has a history of being with us, but no history of ever shooting anybody.
Yeah, exactly.
But being ready to defend people who were trying to exercise their basic human rights.
Right. I want listeners to know also that Jamil Alameen is presently in the federal prison system in Tucson, Arizona. So what's important about this is that this was a Georgia case. It's not a federal case.
Right.
But wherever Jamil Alameen goes, he's so incredibly influential. And when he was accused here in Georgia in that trial, found guilty, and then he was sent to the Reidsville State Prison. It's in the southern part of Georgia. And he was in isolation there.
Mm-hmm.
And the cell next to him, they had the fellow... I think they deliberately put this person there. He was the head of the white supremacist group in Reidsville State Prison. But what's interesting is that the fellow who was the head of the white supremacist, thanks to Jamil Alameen, actually, he became Muslim. And and then also the Muslim inmates in Reidsville asked the Georgia authorities to please make Jamil Alameen the imam for all of the Muslim inmates in the state of Georgia.
Mm-hmm.
So this was too much for the Georgia folks, because somebody as influential as this was just too much for them. So I think that's why they transferred him to the federal prison system.
Imam Jamil continues to challenge his Georgia conviction. There is consensus that Imam Jamil was convicted well before the jury announced its verdict. Contradictions highlighted during the trial and comments made by the prosecution smacked at First Amendment rights. Moreover, Imam Jamil's history as a civil human rights leader at the time of the trial spanned nearly 35 years of governmental surveillance and harassment. Supporters continue to raise the following issues that surfaced during the trial. Prosecution almost systematically eliminated older African-American women who could have been expected to have some knowledge of the FBI's COINTELPRO program, which targeted African-American leaders. Deputies stated that one or even both deputies had shot the assailant. The surviving deputy was emphatic when describing the assailant as having gray eyes. Imam's eyes are brown. The crime scene contained blood on the street and in a neighboring abandoned house. However, the blood was discounted. The deputies offered conflicting accounts of the description of the assailant and clothing worn. The description did not match the imam. The testimony of 9/11 tapes confirming reports of a wounded person in the area of Imam's store of the night of the shooting was not admitted into evidence. The Imam's fingerprints were not found on any firearm associated with the crime. Pieces of evidence relating to the sheriff's vehicle were either lost or destroyed prior to the court proceedings.
FBI agent Ron Campbell, who admitted to kicking and spitting on the imam during the Whitehall, Alabama arrest, escaped total scrutiny as to his role in the case, and local residents refuted the account of the U.S. Marshals who claimed the imam shot at them in Whitehall. Evidence that an individual, Otis Jackson, confessed to be the shooter on the evening of March the 16th, 2000, was never introduced at trial by the prosecution or defense. Otis Jackson continues to maintain that he was the assailant. Imam Jamil's federal habeas addresses discrepancies as well as constitutional errors that occurred during the Georgia trial that resulted in his conviction. In 2002, scholar Michael Thelrell wrote an article about H.Rap Brown / Jamil Al-Amin, a profoundly American story. And in this article, he wrote about a book that Jamil Al-Amin wrote in 1993, and it was entitled Revolution by the Book. Thelrell notes that, liberally illustrated with quotations from the Quran, the Sunnah, and other secondary Islamic texts, El-Amin's tone is learned and reverent and precise. It is an eloquent articulation of the fundamental principles, values, and practice of Orthodox Islam, affecting every aspect of life, personal and social. The revolution it envisions is a moral one, which begins with the individual, stressing awareness of God and self through piety, study, and self-discipline, and moves through family and out into the larger society. Those of us involved with the Jamil El-Amin case are asking for support around the country for his return to Atlanta, an exoneration and or a new trial. Again, this is Heather Gray from WRFG in Atlanta, which is a station affiliated to Pacifica.
And here is an excerpt from A New Vision, an address that Imam Jamil El-Amin delivered in 1990 in Jacksonville, Florida, in which the imam warns of incipient fascism.
Earl Long, who was an astute politician in this society as far as their politicians go, was governor of Louisiana, was once asked, he says, will fascism come to America? He says, yes, fascism will come to America, but it will be called patriotism. The fascist symbol called fasces, get your encyclopedias, used to be carried on the back of a silver dime, the United States silver dime. The symbol of fascism was carried on the dime. What does fascism deal with? When you look at it in terms of Mussolini, you look at it in terms of Hitler, and you have to begin to reflect in terms of recently, in the last 5 or 10 years, all of the programs on your arts and education, your public TV, have been geared around Hitler and his rise to power. Anytime you turn the channel, you'll be able to pick that up, Hitler and his rise to power, because they're teaching, they're instructing, they're conditioning people. You see that in terms of there is a pyramiding of power. This is what the takeovers have been about. The corporations raiding other corporations. There is a pyramiding of power. And this is what the whole sense of fascism is about. Corporation is a word itself that first became used in the fascist regime. And what it deals with again is the whole manifestation of a select group of small groups or individual rising to a point where he has absolute control and authority.
This concludes today's episode of COVID, Race, and Democracy. We thank all Pacifica stations and radio affiliates that contribute to the production of this show. This edition was produced by Steve Seltzer and Polina Vasiliev. Our executive producers are Akua Holt, Polina Vasiliev, and Steve Seltzer. I've been your host, Ann Garrison. Thanks for listening. You can find all episodes of the show at our website, covidtaskforce.pacifica.org.